From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today, two Oscar-nominated films for Best Animated Feature.
Do you ever look at someone and wonder, what is going on inside their head?
Inside Out, the Disney-Pixar film, takes us inside an 11-year-old's mind and the five emotions that control her: fear, anger, disgust, joy, and sadness. We talk with director Pete Docter. Also,
what is it to be human? What is it to ache? What is it to be alive?
Co-directors Charlie Kaufman and Duke Johnson tell us about Anomalisa, their stop-motion animated film that reflects on existential questions. Also, David Edelstein reviews A War, nominated for Best Foreign Film about Danish troops in Afghanistan. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The Academy Awards ceremony is a week from Sunday, and today we have directors of two films nominated for Best Animated Feature. First, Pete Docter, who directed the Disney-Pixar animated film Inside Out, along with Jonas Rivera. Inside Out is also nominated for Best Original Screenplay, which Docter co-wrote. Pete Docter also directed the animated films Monsters, Inc. and Up. Inside Out imagines what goes on in a child's mind ruled by competing emotions. When the film begins, an 11-year-old girl named Riley is uprooted from her home in Minnesota because her father has started a new company in San Francisco. This usually joyful girl becomes sad and angry that she's been forced to leave the house, friends, and hockey team she loves. Much of the film takes place inside her head, in a control room operated by five characters who personify her primary emotions. Joy is voiced by Amy Poehler, anger by Lewis Black, fear by Bill Hader, disgust by Mindy Kaling, and sadness by Phyllis Smith. Terry spoke to Pete Docter in June, and they began with a scene from Inside Out. Riley's in her high chair at the kitchen table with her parents. Her father, voiced by Kyle MacLachlan, is feeding her broccoli. The five emotions in her mind are figuring out how to deal with this dreaded food.
Here we go. All right, open.
This looks new.
Think it's safe?
What is it?
Okay, caution. There is a dangerous smell, people. Hold on, what is that?
This is disgust. She basically keeps Riley from being poisoned, physically and socially.
That is not brightly colored or shaped like a dinosaur. Hold on, guys. It's broccoli! Yuck!
I just saved our lives. Yeah, you're welcome.
Riley, if you don't eat your dinner, you're not gonna get any dessert.
Wait, did he just say we couldn't have dessert?
That's anger. He cares very deeply about things being fair.
So that's how you wanna play it, old man? No dessert? Oh, sure. We'll eat our dinner right after you eat this.
Riley, here comes an airplane.
Oh, airplane. We got an airplane, everybody.
And, of course, the airplane is the spoon that the father's feeding into the child's mouth. Pete Docter, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the film. What gave you the idea of personifying five emotions, joy, anger, sadness, fear, and disgust, and having them at the controls, in the control room of the child's brain?
The idea kind of started with me just thinking about what would be fun to see in animation. You know, what have I not seen? For some reason, I got thinking about the human body and realizing, well, I've seen, like, traveling through the bloodstream and into the, you know, stomach and things. Well, what if we did this in the mind as opposed to the brain? So instead of blood vessels and dendrites, what if it was consciousness and dream production? And that would allow us to have characters that represent emotions. And that felt like, man, that's exactly what animation does best. Strong, opinionated, caricatured personalities. And that just got me excited.
You boiled it down to joy, anger, sadness, fear, and disgust. It seems to me if you were Jewish and perhaps Catholic, guilt would have been a character.
I'm not actually sure if guilt is an emotion. In fact, that was at the very beginning of this process, we realized, man, we really don't know very much about the subject, so we better do some research. And we started looking around online. We found some scientists think that there are basically three emotions. Others went up to 27. Others had 16, somewhere in the middle. So we were kind of left with no definitive answer to our basic question, how many are there? Dr. Paul Ekman, who worked in San Francisco, still does, which is where Pixar Animation Studios is, he had early in his career identified six. That felt like a nice manageable number of guys to design and write for. It was anger, fear, sadness, disgust, joy, and surprise. And as I was sort of doodling, I was thinking, surprise and fear, probably fairly similar. So let's just lose surprise. And that left us with five.
And Mindy Kaling is the voice of disgust. And I've been trying to imagine what it was like for her to get the call saying, we'd like you to personify disgust.
Yeah, I know. We kind of worried about that one. We did say she's disgusted. She's not disgusting. And that kind of assuaged her fears a little bit. But she came in. We gave her a pitch. She was actually pretty key to decoding some elements of the story. We were really wrestling with these two different themes of growing up and then embracing sadness, which we felt were kind of separate. But I don't know. I had an intuition that they could somehow be connected. I pitched her the story. And as I turned around, because I was pitching kind of off some visuals on the computer, I turned around and she's crying. And I thought, oh, no, what? Did she get like a bad text or something? You know, she was really responded emotionally. And she said, I'm sorry. I just think it's really beautiful that you guys are making a story that tells kids that it's difficult to grow up and that it's okay to be sad about it. And that we were like, quick, write that down, you know, because that was really what we were trying to say.
It is the kind of moral of the story that if you cut off sadness, you're not going to feel anything when you're sad, and that that's the worst thing of all, and that sadness is the way to be able to communicate what you're really feeling with other people.
Yeah. One of the other experts we consulted with, this guy named Dacher Keltner, he was big on sadness as a community bonding. I think is the word he uses, like, you know, if you're sad, it's a way of connecting with other people. And we, a lot of times we sort of feel embarrassed by being sad and we go off by ourselves to hide and cry by ourselves. But really it's a way of reestablishing relationship.
Well, people discourage us from being sad. It's like, oh, smile. Oh, cheer up. And I think it's often that way with children. I know when I was a child and I wasn't smiling and I was walking down the street, there'd always be a stranger coming up to me saying, come on, smile. And I thought, like,
yeah,
get out of my face, you know, like, leave me alone. But
it is one of those weird social things. You're right. Even as parents, we say, oh, don't be sad. You know, come here. We'll distract you with some ice cream or something. And I don't know if that's always the best thing, but it's certainly you understand why people do it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Pete Docter, and he directed and co-wrote the new Pixar Disney movie Inside Out. And it's an animated film that goes into the mind of an 11-year-old child where joy, fear, anger, disgust, and sadness are all at headquarters, the control room in her brain, kind of competing to control her emotions. And it also imagines what goes on in your mind when you're making a memory, storing the memory, deleting a memory. And that must have been a very challenging part for you, because the brain is really a lot of neurons and electricity and electrical currents and stuff. And it's not like there's a storage room with memories in it. But, of course, you create a storage room with memories. And the memories, each memory is like an image encased in a glass-like ball that can be broken if you're not careful. It can roll away. It can things can happen to it. You have to be careful with your memories.
That's right.
Can you talk a little bit about figuring out if you're trying to kind of make a analogy or a metaphor out of memory, how are you going to do it so that children and adults will both not only comprehend it, but feel like it's accurate in some metaphorical way?
Yeah, the way real memories work, from what we understand, is really complex. it's a interconnection of different things and redundancy in the brain. So the idea of a memory existing as a little snow globe, the way we've represented in the film, is actually not scientifically accurate at all. However, for story reasons, we needed to represent them in certain ways. One of the things that sort of blew me away that I didn't know when we started is that memories are completely susceptible to change. And this is, you know, one of the many reasons why certain people are trying to get it taken out eyewitness testimony in court cases, because it's very unreliable. Every time you recall a memory, you're basically making another copy of it, and at that same point, it is susceptible to new changes and adaptations. So, you know, if you remember from when you were, you know, in second grade and there was Christmas and you got a present from your grandfather and your mom was wearing a red dress, that may or may not all have happened. It might have been introduced slowly over the course of the years as you recall this memory over and over. So that was a very cool but complex idea that we thought about representing in the film but could not find a way to make it work. We actually needed the memory, if you see the film, as a very different kind of a plot device of revealing some information to our main character. So we chose to represent it as these sort of beautiful little snow globes, which kind of, weirdly, that's the way we think of memories, at least most of the folks that we talk to. You think of these memories as being very pure and absolute and unchanging. That's not actually real life.
Yes, and that's why in your film, if sadness touches one of the memories, the memory turns blue and is forever changed by the sadness it's been touched by. And
yeah,
which gets to exactly what you're talking about, that memories change over time as we recall them.
Though that actually is scientifically accurate. If you are feeling sad right now and you recall a sad memory or a very happy memory from the past, it will be tinged with more sadness based on your current feeling. So we felt like that was actually on solid scientific ground.
There is sadness in this story in Inside Out because the 11-year-old girl is forced to move from her home in Minnesota. Her father, I think her father has a startup, and it's in San Francisco. So the family, you know, this 11-year-old and her mother and father have to move to San Francisco, and she's leaving behind the house that she loves, the little lake she loves to skate on, her hockey team, her friends. And they moved to San Francisco. The house is kind of, you know, run down on, and she's just like so sad at having left everything behind. And I think that's such a scary thought for a parent, you know, that the parent is making the change that has to be made, but it's going to create such sadness in the child.
Yeah. Yeah, we were looking for a way to represent adulthood and the passing into adulthood. And I think for me personally and a lot of the folks that I work with, childhood is kind of a sacred, special kind of point in time that has a real joy and purity to it. And we sort of long on a daily basis to reach back and kind of grab onto that in some way. So this idea of moving seemed like a good way to sort of represent that metaphorically. It also is something for me personally, when I was in fifth grade, so about 11, my folks moved us to Denmark. And so not only did I have all new friends and all new surroundings, I didn't even understand what they were talking about, which was very difficult and kind of started me, I think, on my path to animation. It was a lot easier to draw people than to talk and interact with them. So,
why did your family move to Denmark?
My father was working on his PhD on Danish choral music, the Danish choral music of Carl Nielsen. So over there to do research.
In the movie, it's the father's job, the father's new startup that takes the family to San Francisco and makes 11-year-old Riley say goodbye to everybody, you know, all the friends she loves and the school she knows and everything. And in your life, it was your father's doctoral work in Denmark that took you away from your home. You're a father now, and I'm sure you relate to the father as well as to the child in the film, the father who has to move the family away, and also the father who, as soon as they get to their new home, his cell phone rings, and it's like, okay, the backer for his startup, who he was supposed to meet with later in the week, is there now, and so he's got to leave right away to get off to this meeting, and the child feels totally abandoned by daddy. Do you feel kind of weird when, in the past, and your kids were young, and you had to say goodbye to them, or not say hello to them because you had to do your animation meeting or whatever, that here you are working really hard to do wonderful entertainment for children, and that's why you can't be with your children.
Yeah, to bring families together, I need to go away.
Exactly.
Bye, kids.
Yeah.
Well, we definitely try to have a balance, and I think things have gotten a lot better at Pixar. When we did Toy Story, that was an all-hands-on-deck situation that really was time-intensive. Since then, we've tried to regulate things so that you at least get to go home at night and not have to pull all-nighters and see them on weekends and things. So, you know, like everything in life, it's a balance.
Filmmaker Pete Docter speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. This is Fresh Air, and we're listening to Terry's interview with Pete Docter, who co-directed the Oscar-nominated animated feature Inside Out.
So I've read that there was a point at which you were supposed to show part of the film to John Lasseter, the founder of Pixar, but you had nothing to show, and you felt like a real failure at that point. How did you handle that emotionally? Like, what got you through that feeling of maybe this isn't going to work?
Well, the film initially, we had decided to pair joy with fear because, I don't know about you, for me, fear was a major motivator in junior high. So we thought there's probably some good stuff there. As the film went on, we had developed all these great scenes that were really funny, but in the third act, it wasn't adding up to anything. And, you know, you want Joy now, having learned her lesson, to go back to headquarters to do something that she would never have been able to do in the first act. But what exactly is that? I don't know. And at this time, we had spent almost 3 years working on the film. I knew that there was an upcoming screening where not only were we going to show it to everybody else at the studio, we also needed to move into production. And yet I was sitting there in editorial going, this is not working. I'm a failure. I mean, these other films were flukes. I don't know what I'm doing. I should just quit. What would I miss? I'd miss my house and I'd miss going to work. But I think the thing that I realized I would miss most is probably similar to everybody, which is your friends. And it's sort of hit me that the very subject matter of the film that I'm dealing with is the key to the most important thing in our lives, and that's our relationships. And so we had done all this research showing the job of each individual emotion. You know, fear keeps you safe. It deals with uncertainty. Anger is about fairness. If it feels that you're getting ripped off or taken advantage of, that's when anger comes up. Sadness deals with loss. And I suddenly had this new revelation, it felt like to me, that those are all true, but the real deeper reason we have emotions is to connect us together. And that felt big to me. And I suddenly had an idea that we needed to get fear out of there and sadness connected with joy. And I ran back. I called the producer Jonas Rivera and Ronnie Del Carmen, who's our co-director, and we met that Sunday night, and I kind of went through this whole spiel with them. And I was kind of expecting them to sink into their chairs and, you know, bury their hands in their faces because the pressure was pretty great. Instead, they totally lit up. And so the three of us went to John and to Ed and the rest of the we sort of call it the brain trust, you know, other filmmakers. So the cool thing was they very quickly understood why and were totally on board why this new thing was an improvement. So they got on board and we moved on. It was a scary moment, but it was the right call in the long run.
Can I point out that I think the real hero of the story you just told was fear? Because seriously, it was fear of failure that got you to realize that sadness had to be more of a main character in the movie.
That is true.
So
that is true. Maybe there's another movie in there where fear is the hero.
Let's pay our respects to fear.
Yeah.
Let's give fear its
great
props.
Motivator.
Yeah. But, you know, you said that, like, fear was such an important motivator when you were in junior high school. Isn't it still?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. More than I'd probably care to admit. And in part, that's good. But then, like any emotion, and this is something we learned from the research as well, there are positive and negative aspects to all of these.
Yes. You haven't had a film that failed, but and I hope you never do, but I always imagine what it's like when I do see a movie that's pretty bad, and I think somebody spent years of their life working on this, and it's not good. Imagine how they must feel. No one's going to go see it. Do you live in fear of that? That someday you'll spend like 5 years making an animated film, and it won't be good, and that's like 5 years of your life.
Absolutely. You know, but the truth is, at some point, our films, almost every single one of them, are really bad. And it's largely hats off to John Lasseter and Ed Catmull, who have set up a system whereby they're expecting it. They're expecting us to make mistakes. And they've set up a process that allows us to correct for that and do it again and iterate. So I think that's a real key to the films that we've made.
What is that process?
Well, what we do is we have a script, of course, but for us, writing is also like storyboarding. It's drawing. And so we will cut all of those drawings together with music, sound effects, and dialogue, and we screen this kind of stick figure version of the film. So we can sit with Lee Unkrich and Andrew Stanton and all the other folks and experience what the film is going to be like. And then we go away into a room and we talk about what worked and what didn't. And then we take all those findings and we do that whole process again. And it's about a 3-month process every screening. And that way we have 7 or 8 chances at the film before we have to actually build the models, build the sets, do the animation and all of that. So I think that's a real key to the way we make films.
So now that the movie is opening, are you going to see Inside Out with audiences and see what the reaction is like in just like a theater of random people?
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's one of the real joys for me is going out and watching. And usually I'm not watching the screen. I'm kind of sitting and looking off to the side, spying on people to see what they react to. Because it's, as Joe Ranft used to say, you know, animation is like telling a joke and waiting for 3 years to see if anyone laughs.
That's great. Pete Docter, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was fun.
Pete Docter speaking with Terry Gross last year. Docter co-directed the film Inside Out, which has earned an Oscar nomination for Best Animated Feature. After a break, we'll speak with the directors of Anomalisa, the stop-motion animated film in which doll-sized puppets are used to tell an existential love story. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from None Such Records featuring Side Pony, the new album by Lake Street Dive, including the song Call Off Your Dogs, Lake Street Dive, available at Amazon.com. And from Home Instead Senior Care, with a range of in-home senior care services to keep aging loved ones at home, from companionship and help around the house to medication reminders and Alzheimer's care, at homeinstead.com/NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today we're featuring two films nominated for Best Animated Feature at the Academy Awards ceremony a week from Sunday. The movie Anomalisa is an existential love story about loneliness and disconnection. It uses stop-motion animation and doll-sized, realistic-looking puppets. All the sets are handmade miniature versions of the world around us, everything from planes and taxis to a hotel room and city streets. In December, Terry spoke with the film's directors, Charlie Kaufman and Duke Johnson. Kaufman, who wrote the screenplay, also wrote Being John Malkovich, Adaptation, and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Anomalisa is about a middle-aged man, Michael Stone, who flies to Cincinnati where he's scheduled to speak at a conference of customer service representatives. Although he's an expert in customer service, he can't connect emotionally with anyone, not even his wife and child. Everyone looks and sounds the same to him, literally, until he meets Lisa, a woman with a unique face and voice. But it's hard for her to connect because a facial scar has left her feeling disfigured and ugly. So she's astonished Michael invites her to his hotel room for a nightcap instead of choosing her more attractive friend, Emily. Michael's voiced by David Thewlis, Lisa by Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Most people don't really like to look at me too much because, you know.
I think you're lovely.
No, you don't. I've always done phone work because I'd never get hired to work in a store or a restaurant or...
How did it happen? If it's okay for me to ask.
I don't like to talk about it.
May I kiss you there?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God, no. Oh, God.
Sorry.
You're not like a pervert or something. Like some weird version of a chubby chaser.
No.
I just don't understand why you would want to kiss me there.
Because I like you.
Why? I mean, I'm not smart like Emily, and I'm ugly. You're a really smart guy. You should like Emily. I don't even understand a lot of the words in your book. I sat there with the dictionary. I try to learn, but I'm never going to be smart. And I'm ugly.
I find it enormously charming that you read any book with a dictionary next to you.
And that's a scene from Anomalisa. Charlie Kaufman, Duke Johnson, welcome to Fresh Air. Charlie Kaufman, let me start with you. How would you describe Michael Stone's state of mind? He wants to connect, but everyone looks and sounds the same to him, with the exception of Lisa.
Yeah. His state of mind, I guess, is an inability to connect with people. I don't know other than that what to say. I mean, he's a depressed person, and he's obviously very lonely because of this, and very frustrated, and I think angry.
He stays at the Fregoli Hotel. So, of course, I Googled Fregoli, and there's actually something called the Fregoli delusion, which is, Charlie, you want to describe the delusional belief that's given the name Fregoli?
Yeah, it's a belief that everyone else in the world is the same person in disguise.
It's one person disguising themselves as all these other people?
Yes. It's usually a result of some sort of organic or traumatic brain problem. And in this movie, I used it kind of metaphorically. I wasn't intending for Michael to actually have this condition, but it interested me. The name comes from an Italian quick change artist who apparently, because he's very, I think it was from maybe the late 19th century, early 20th century, so I don't think there's any record of it, but apparently he was amazing at changing his costumes on stage immediately in front of people without them understanding how he did it.
And how did you find out about this?
I have a tendency to read about syndromes. And so, you know, I mean, I look up things like that and I'm fascinated by them, you know, as actual things in the world, but they also seem psychologically interesting to me to utilize.
So you have all the characters, with the exception of the two characters that we heard, the rest of the characters are all voiced by Tom Noonan. And it's very disorienting at the beginning of the movie because a woman's speaking, but you're hearing Tom Noonan's voice. And then you realize, gee, Tom Noonan's voice seems to be like every voice. And then you start to understand that you're seeing and hearing things from the main character's point of view. It's a really interesting decision for you to have made, to have all the characters, with the exception of Michael and Lisa, have the same voice.
Yeah, I mean, the reason that I came to this is because it was originally a radio play or a staged radio play, and I was trying to utilize voices in a kind of an interesting way, and it was a very low-budget production. I could only afford, you know, to cast three actors. So I thought, you know, what if one person plays all the other people and, you know, I'd read about the Fregoli thing and it seemed to sort of lend itself to it. So that's where it originally came from. And of course, it carried over into the film. And the faces are all the same as well, which was not an issue in the play, but is something we decided on here.
So another part about the story I want to ask you about before we get to the animation. The character of Michael is a customer service guru. You know, he's written a self-help book for customer service agents. He's giving a speech at a customer service conference. And the speech he makes, I just want to play a short excerpt of it, is really fascinating because it's like he knows all the platitudes about customer service, about always smiling and, you know, recognizing that everybody is unique. But this speech becomes for him this kind of like existential crisis that he's bringing all these other things into. So I just want to play an excerpt of the opening of his speech to the customer service representatives.
Always remember the customer is an individual, just like you. Each person you speak to has had a day. Some of the days have been good, some bad, but they've all had one. Each person you speak to has had a childhood. Each has a body. Each body has aches. What is it to be human? What is it to ache? What is it to be alive? I don't know. What is it to ache? I don't know. What is it to be alive? I don't know.
Okay, not the kind of self-help pep talk you'd expect at a customer service conference. Charlie, to prepare for that, did you read the platitudinous self-help books in addition to thinking about the more existential things you wanted to get in there and the kind of just like mental health issues the character's having?
No, not really. I have a lot of experience in customer service. I did customer service work for probably a decade. So when I decided to give Michael that job, I did it for a couple of reasons, because I had the experience, but also because I thought it was funny that there would be somebody out there whose career this would be, to be a customer service guru. I subsequently found out that there actually is somebody out there. I heard him on NPR who goes around and talks about it. So I thought I invented it, but I didn't. I didn't really have to do much research.
What kind of customer service rep were you?
I worked at the Roundabout Theater, dealing with subscribers. I worked at the Metropolitan Opera, selling tickets. I worked at the Star Tribune in Minneapolis, answering customer complaints about delivery.
Animation seems perfect for this story because it's about a character who's trapped in his head, who's not living in the real world, and is kind of having a dissociative experience. Do you both see it that way, that this is, because it's kind of going on in someone's head, that to be able to create the world from scratch is a good opportunity?
I think that there's something about this type of animation that communicates fragility and humanity and brokenness in a way that other types don't necessarily, because it's all handmade and because it's an imperfect process. You can see the signs of the animators. You can see the remnants of them on the puppets. You can see the way the puppets move, but you can also see chatter on the clothing where the animators have moved them. You can see it in the hair.
Can you explain the kind of stop-motion animation that you use in this movie and how everything in the movie is handmade, from the airplane and the taxi cab to the people to the hotel room, the cityscape? Everything is just miniatures that have been made by artists and animators.
That's correct. We fabricate everything. Everything that you see on the screen is made by hand. It's all in 1/6 scale, which is a Barbie's scale for a frame of reference. So all the locations and sets and cars, and it all exists in real three-dimensional space. none of it actually physically moves in real time. Everything is static, and the puppets are posed in various static positions in a sequence over the course of a series of frames. And when the frames are played back in real time, it creates the illusion of movement.
Kind of like, what are they called? The flip things.
Flip books,
like a
or
flip
a zoetrope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Charlie Kaufman and Duke Johnson speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, offering online consumer tools and reviews dedicated to promoting fairness and transparency about local service pricing and quality. More information is available at angieslist.com. And from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, where nutritional therapy is part of every patient's treatment plan to help boost their immune system and manage side effects during treatment. More about integrative cancer care is available at cancercenter.com.
This is Fresh Air, and we're listening to Terry's interview recorded in December with Charlie Kaufman and Duke Johnson. Their stop-motion animation film Anomalisa has earned an Oscar nomination for Best Animated Feature.
Duke, when you're shooting these, was it one-sixth size?
One-sixth
ratio.
Yeah.
So everything's like a sixth of the size it would be in reality.
I was just going to say Michael is our tallest character. He's 12 inches, and that's the equivalent of being 6 feet tall.
So just so we can visualize how this is done, are all the sets like on a table or are they on the floor? What kind of angle does the photographer have to get to be able to realistically shoot these miniature sets?
Yeah, so basically, we have a big empty warehouse where stages are created, different stages. In our case, we had 18 that are separated by sheets of duvetyne that are hung from the ceiling. So you have these sort of black rooms created out of this duvetyne fabric that's used in filmmaking because it has no bounce quality for light. Like if you create a room out of duvetyne, there's total blackness and you have a blank slate to introduce light and create the atmosphere of your choosing. So you have separate rooms divided by this black fabric, and they're anywhere from 15 feet by 15 feet to 40 feet by 20 feet or something. And there's a set in each one of these stages, and there's an animator. And, you know, for something like the hotel room, in our case, the hotel room is a large part of the film. So we had to build several hotel rooms. We had 8. And they would be on various stages, and sometimes different parts of the same scene would be animated simultaneously by different animators on multiple stages because the process moves so slowly. It can often take weeks or months to animate a single shot. What happens is we go in and you pose the puppets, you sort of stage it as you would with live action, and then you set the camera angle and you secure it into place. Typically with glue, actually. You actually glue the camera into place so that it doesn't move and you can't bump it over time. And then the cinematographer lights it, you know, just like you would a live action set, but it's just on a miniature scale. It almost looks like a blueprint or a diagram of a live action set.
One of the really difficult things that the animators had to do was animate Michael's naked body. And there's a scene it's actually kind of funny. He's in his hotel room and he takes off his clothes and goes into the shower. And as happens so frequently in a shower in a hotel where you haven't stayed before, you don't know which direction is hot and which direction is cold and how to set the water. So, you know, first it's way too cold and then it's way too hot. And he's just like really angry at the shower until it gets just right. And then he steps out of the shower and you see, you know, a full frontal naked body. And it is so realistic looking. And you even see, as he moves, you see his genitals gently move back and forth in the way that they do in real life. And I can't imagine how, like, technically complicated that must have been, considering you're working with little Barbie doll-sized puppets. How do you get that kind of anatomically correct movement?
Well, you know, these animators are particularly skilled in understanding biology and physics and how things move. We intentionally design these puppets to feel like real people in the sense that they have average bodies. That plays a big part into the authenticity of the moment. They don't look, you know, like they're modeled after some iconic form or archetype. It's just sort of average and asymmetrical and irregular and specific. You know, there was one animator that was asked to animate that moment, and he decided that he couldn't do it because he felt that the main character resembled his father and that would be too awkward for him to do. But it is particularly difficult to animate a naked puppet because the puppet itself, there's nothing, there's no clothing or material to sort of hide behind. You can see the body, it's there, it's exposed, and every subtle movement will be realized by the audience. That particular moment is difficult because he's wet when he gets out of the shower, and that wetness is a type of a lubricant that has to be consistently added every frame or every sequence of frames because it dries over time. You know, his body has hair in it, and the hair isn't actually animatable, so you have to sort of move the body without disturbing the hair. You know, all of these subtle features, but just trying to get naturalistic movements and make it look like it's really existing in space, like it has the proper amount of gravity and weight and movement.
There's a scene in the movie where the woman who's voiced by Jennifer Jason Leigh and who is certain that she's ugly and therefore unlovable, Michael asks her to sing a song because he thinks she's really special, and she says she likes to sing but only when she's alone. And he kind of like convinces her to sing. And she sings Girls Just Want to Have Fun. But there's such melancholy in the song. It's like the saddest version ever of Girls Just Want to Have Fun. She sings it from the point of view of somebody who would love to have fun but probably never has and fears that she never will. She wants to be the one who walks in the sun but is confident she never will. Charlie, how did you choose that song and decide to find the sadness within it?
In the play, it was a different song. It was My Heart Will Go On from Titanic, and we couldn't afford it. So we were scrambling to find something else for Lisa to sing. It was actually, we were already at the recording session, and we hadn't decided on what it was going to be yet, and we had ideas of songs that might work, and Girls Just Want to Have Fun is one of them. And so at the time, you know, there's an uncertainty about which way to go because it was this other thing before. But once Jennifer sang it and we realized, you know, what the significance of it is for her character and you know, with the way Jennifer did it, it became clear to us that that was the song to use. And, you know, that's the way Lisa would sing it. So we had her do it that way.
I want to thank you both so much and congratulate you on the film. Duke Johnson, Charlie Kaufman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Some boys take a beautiful girl and hide her away from the rest of the world. I want to be the one to walk in the sun. And girls, they want to have fun. Oh, girls just want to have. That's all they really want. Some fun when the working day is done. Oh, girls, they wanna have fun. Oh, girls, just wanna have fun.
Anomalisa has earned an Academy Award nomination for the Best Animated Feature Film. Terry spoke with directors Charlie Kaufman and Duke Johnson in December. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new film, A War. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Film critic David Edelstein has a review of the new film called A War. It tells a fictional story about Danish soldiers in Afghanistan, where Denmark, a member of the NATO alliance, has had a military presence. Written and directed by Tobias Lindholm, the film is one of five movies nominated for this year's Foreign Language Oscar to be awarded February 28th.
The writer-director Tobias Lindholm's A War centers on a Danish commander's error in judgment, which can be viewed, depending on your perspective, as a tragic mistake or a war crime, or both. It's a movie that pulls you in so many different directions, it leaves you in pieces, devastated. The commander is Klaus Pedersen, played by Pilou Asbæk, who looks a bit like Ewan McGregor and will be seen later this year as Pontius Pilate in the remake of Ben-Hur. Yes, there's a Ben-Hur remake. Pedersen's squad is in rural Afghanistan, charged with protecting Afghan civilians from assaults by the Taliban. He's an unusually hands-on commander, going on patrols with his men even when he doesn't have to. He's there when one of his companies steps on an IED and bleeds out in agony. Later, a traumatized soldier named Lasse begs to leave, but Pedersen tells him gently but firmly that he can't return home to Denmark. Pedersen has to tell his own wife as much when she begs him to come back, saying their three sons need him. One boy is acting out towards other kids. The little one eats something he shouldn't and is rushed to the hospital. And Pedersen is similarly firm when an Afghan man and his family risk their lives by showing up at the gates of the base and begging to be taken in. The man's daughter received medical treatment from the Danes, and he's convinced the Taliban will retaliate by killing him, his wife, and his children. But Pedersen won't be swayed, even when a fellow officer, a woman, gazes at him appalled. Regulations are regulations. I won't spell out what happens next, but it's a worst-case scenario on many fronts. An attack from all directions, in a civilian sector, by Taliban soldiers whom the Danes can't even see, much less count. That traumatized soldier, Lasse, is badly wounded, and there's no way a medevac helicopter can land without information about the enemy's location that Pedersen doesn't have. Every choice is potentially disastrous. So-called elementary rules of engagement don't seem so elementary. Lindholm is best known for two strong films, The Hunt, starring Mads Mikkelsen as an unjustly shunned teacher, and A Hijacking, another thriller that comes down to terrible choices and ends on a bitterly tragic note. For A War, he uses a swervy handheld camera in Afghanistan and more plain, prosaic setups when the action shifts to a courtroom in Denmark. The two parts of A War are unlike in style and tempo, but of course, they're not meant to fit together. Pedersen's lawyer, as well as the soldiers under his command, ask how a Denmark jury can pass judgment when they weren't there, under fire. if it's difficult to dismiss the fierce moral outrage of Pedersen's female prosecutor, it's almost impossible to root for a conviction. In both cases, humanity loses. But then, it's already lost. Women and children have died. Soldiers remain in Afghanistan, protecting people they don't understand, against an enemy that makes a practice of hiding behind such women and children. You might expect a scene in which Pedersen weeps or shares his anguish, but as Asbeck plays him, he's frozen in time, unlikely ever to emerge from under his protective shell. As an artist, Lindholm doesn't have to pass sentence on his protagonist to say whether or not he meets the definition of a war criminal. Claus Pedersen was clearly out of his depth. The question is, how many people would be in their depth under conditions so hellish?
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. On Monday's show, as scientists struggle to understand and contain the Zika virus, we speak with science writer Sonia Shah about the troubling emergence of rapidly spreading diseases and the chances of an outbreak that could kill tens of millions. Her new book is Pandemic. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting The Lady in the Van with Maggie Smith, directed by Nicholas Heitner. Based on Alan Bennett's true story of a woman who parks her van in his driveway and lives there for 15 years. Now in select theaters. And from Squarespace, providing tools to help people showcase their passions with a customizable landing page, website, or online store. Learn more at squarespace.com/NPR.